And so I'd ask you to turn to 1 Samuel. And we want to look a little bit at the beginning of this story, because here was a man who, in a very real sense, lived in transition times. If you look carefully at the story, you realize that what we have here is a man who stood between the time of the judges and the time of the kings. And so, to that extent, Samuel looks back and also looks forward. And of course, this is, to me, one of the things about the word Ebenezer, that it looks back as we remember all that God has done. And that gives us confidence to look forward. But I want to read, starting in chapter 1, and for the sake of time, we're just going to read a few verses scattered through the chapter. Starting at verse 1, "Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim, Zophim, of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, the name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there." And then down to verse 8. "Then Elkanah," in the intervening verses, of course, we have the record of Hannah crying out to God for a child. Verse 8, "Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, 'Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?' So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed to the Lord, and wept in anguish. Then she made a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant, and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head.' And it happened, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, 'How long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you.' And Hannah answered and said, 'No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now.' Then Eli answered and said, 'Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition, which you have asked of him.' And she said, 'Let your maidservant find favor in your sight.' So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad." And then we find that during that period of time that she had a son, dropping down to verse 24. "Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bulls, one ephah of flour, and a skin of wine, excuse me, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli, and she said, 'O my lord, as your soul lives, my lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition which I asked of him. Therefore I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord.' So they worshiped the Lord there." And then over to chapter 2. chapter 2 and verse 11. Then Elkanah went to his house at Ramah, but the child ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. Now the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself all that the flesh hook brought up. So they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who sacrificed, "Give meat for roasting to the priest, for he will not take boiled meat from you, but raw." And if the man said to him, "They should really burn the fat first, then you may take as much as your heart desires," he would then answer him, "No, but you must give it to me now, and if not, I will take it by force." Therefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord. But Samuel ministered before the Lord, even as a child, wearing a linen ephod. Moreover, his mother used to make him a little robe and bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. And Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "The Lord give you descendants from this woman for the loan that was lent to the Lord." Then they would go to their own home. And the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the child grew before the Lord. Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress." And then chapter 3 and verse 1, "Then the boy Samuel ministered to the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation. It came to pass that at that time, while Eli was lying down in his place, and when his eyes had begun to grow so dim that he could not see, and before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down to sleep, that the Lord called Samuel, and he answered, 'Here I am.' So he ran to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' And he said, 'I did not call, lie down again.' And he went and lay down. The Lord called yet again, 'Samuel.' So Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' And he answered, 'I did not call, my son, lie down again.' Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. And the Lord called Samuel yet again a third time. Then he arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you did call me.' Then Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, 'Go, lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you must say, "Speak, Lord, for your servant hears."' So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Then the Lord came and stood and called as at other times, 'Samuel, Samuel.' And Samuel answered, 'Speak, for your servant hears.'" We trust the Lord will bless these portions to our hearts. As I said, this story comes at what was really a transition time. And as I look at what was going on here in Israel at this time, and recognizing that at the end of the book of Judges, we read that every man did what was right in his own eyes. There was no king in Israel. We recognize the anarchy that there was in the country at that time. But the thing that really struck me in reading this and looking at it was, it's not just what was out there. And it's easy for us sometimes as believers to get this kind of a concept in our minds that conditions are out there And I think sometimes we need to examine ourselves and to check on our own hearts and our own circumstances within the assemblies of the Lord's people, and to see whether perhaps some of the things that are happening out there are perhaps because of our own condition. I was looking at your little sign back there on the back wall where it says that some of the things that are going on in the world are maybe because the Word of God doesn't have its place in our hearts. And certainly as you read what we have here, the first thing that really is striking is the fact of a demoralized priesthood. Here was a man, Eli, that was supposed to be the representative of the people. He was supposed to be the high priest. And there are a number of things that are said concerning him that should not have been. And the first thing that we find about him is that he was a priest that was sitting down. Now, I don't need to tell you that when you read through the description of the furniture in the tabernacle, there was never a seat. And the implication was that the work of the priest was never finished, that he was constantly to be seen standing and serving in the presence of God. And yet here's Eli, and twice it's recorded of him. We read of it here in chapter 1. You read of it again in chapter 4, that he was sitting down. Now, granted, he was an old man. I understand that he was probably about 89 years of age. So, in a way, it was maybe a little understandable. And yet, I think that the Spirit of God emphasizes this for us, the fact that here was a man who was supposed to be standing and ministering before the Lord, and the picture that we are given of him is a man that was sitting down. Another thing that stands out in connection with Eli is that he was not only seated, but he was sightless. And we read in chapter 3 that his eyes were dim. But I would like to suggest to you that he not only had problem with his vision physically, but spiritually as well. And I think that comes out here in chapter 1. Because here he is sitting there at the door of the tabernacle, and Hannah comes in her anguish of soul, standing and praying before God, pouring out her heart. And he mistook her concern, he mistook her anguish for drunkenness. And it was certainly a lack of discernment on his part. He should have seen and recognized. And again, I look at myself as one that works by the grace of God among the people of God. And I have to ask myself from time to time, how much discernment do I have? You know, one of the things that really has struck me in recent times, and particularly because of certain things that have happened in our own assembly, that people can come and be coming faithfully to meetings, and to all appearances, everything is going fine. They seem to be happy, they seem to be bright, they seem to be going along well, but underneath there are hidden problems. And sometimes we that are working and serving among the people of God need to have that measure of discernment. And here was Eli, the man that was charged by God to be the representative of the people before God. And yet as he sees this woman, he does not discern her anguish of soul, and instead he charges her with drunkenness. So he was not only sightless as far as his physical condition was concerned, but as far as his spiritual discernment as well. Another thing that you see in connection with Eli is the fact that he was sleeping. And I know it's easy to fall asleep. It's easy sometimes when things, you know, I don't know how many of you stayed up to watch the ball drop on Thursday night, was it? And you're just dragging the next day, and sometimes it takes 2 or 3 days to recover from, if you're not accustomed to this kind of thing. But I think again, it's indicative of the condition of this man, that he was a man who, when it came to the service of God, the thing that is recorded of him, he was lying down, sleeping, and instead of being active. And I think that what we have here in chapter 3, it says, well, while Eli was lying down and his eyes had begun to grow dim, and before the lamp of God went out, so that these things are all put together there as an indication of the lack that there was as far as Eli was concerned. And then perhaps the most serious of all in connection with him, and that's why we read those verses in chapter 2, was that he was soft with his sons. And this perhaps was the most serious of all, because here were his sons that were carrying on in despicable ways, to the point where, as it says in verse 17 of chapter 2, that men abhorred the sacrifice of the Lord because of the conduct of these men. And instead of rebuking them, instead of dealing with the matter, he just says to them, why do you do such things? No, my sons, it's not a good report. And he's soft with these. And this is something which, again, is something that we really need to examine ourselves before the Lord. It can be a very difficult thing sometimes to rebuke in your own family. We see things, and sometimes we're closer to those in our own family than people that are outside, and we see things going on, and it can be a very difficult thing sometimes. And yet here was a man who was charged with the leading of the nation as far as their spiritual life was concerned, and instead of dealing with this matter, and we find that God took a very serious view of it, because as we'll see in a minute, this was the sin that was charged to Eli, that instead of dealing with the condition with his sons, that he allowed them to continue in this way. And so the first thing that we see here in connection with the conditions in the land was a demoralized priest. And then, as we were saying, you have depraved sons. And really, as you read the description of the things that were going on, some of the things were absolutely terrible. In the first place, as we read there in chapter 2, they profaned the sacrifices. People would come and they would bring the sacrifices. And these two men, Hophni and Phinehas, as people came to offer their sacrifices to the Lord, they wanted their own portion first. And this business about putting in the three-pronged flesh hook and taking it, and then asking for the fat, that because they wanted roast meat instead of boiled meat, these were things God had ordained them, and they were rebelling against the commands of God, and to that extent were profaning the sacrifices of God. Not only that, the very fact that they wanted roasted meat instead of boiled meat, they were pandering to their appetites. You know, roast meat is a little more tasty sometimes than boiled meat, and to that extent you can understand. But here were men that God had laid down certain rules and regulations as to how things ought to have been conducted, and these men were superseding that and pandering to their own appetites. And then you have that dreadful thing that you read in verse 22, that they lay with the women, and here they were polluting the holy place, that the very place that was supposed to be the holy place of the presence of God was being polluted by the action of these men. And God could not tolerate this, and God said it was something that had to be dealt with. But unfortunately, as you read all of this, one of the things again that comes out is that it was not only a demoralized priest and depraved sons, but we find that it was a disinterested nation. And I have to say, and I hope I don't cause any offense with anybody that's here today, that one of the things that astounds me in this country and in all that has been going on is the fact of the disinterest of the nation. Here is a man who is the leader of our country, and as long as he's doing a good job politically, they don't care about his personal life, they don't care about things that are going on. And it seems to me that this is indicative, this is a picture of the kind of things that we have here. And you go back into the book of Judges, and you see some of the things that were going on there, especially in those latter chapters of the book of Judges. And not just physical anarchy, but you find that spiritually things were at a very, very low state. And so the book opens here in 1 Samuel, and you find that a man who was of the Levitical tribe, it says that he was an Ephraimite, but if you look at it carefully, you find that he was a man who really was within the Levitical family, and yet he was guilty of polygamy. So that as far as morals were concerned, they had let down on the things of God. And again, we look at our country, and one of the tragic things that we see in this country is the way in which morals have become so loose. I was assigned a very difficult topic at the workers' conference that was held out in Kansas in October, where I was asked to speak on the subject of divorce and the rehabilitation of divorced people. And the more I looked into it and the more I saw and read, it is estimated that 3 out of every 4 marriages in this country end in divorce. And we shake our heads at that. But the thing that struck me even more is that 2 out of every 4 Christian marriages so often end in divorce. Almost 50% of Christian marriages. And I was just, you maybe saw it yourselves, on the news, they were saying, I think it's in Texas, that or Florida, is it, where they're now passing a law where they're going to ban these quickie marriages. And if a person wants to get married, they have to have a 3-day waiting period. You talk about guns, you know, that you have to have a period while they check into your background for buying a handgun. But here in marriage now, that even the secular world is seeing the tremendous need that there is, and they're insisting that men and women go through a 4-hour period of premarital counseling because of the tremendous surge and uprise that there is in this thing. And here is a man who knew the laws of God, and yet you find that he was living in polygamy with 2 wives. Now I recognize that you go back into the book of Genesis and you find that men like Jacob and later on David and many of these people, but these are things that show the condition of the land at that time. And not only were they careless about God's laws, God had ordained at the beginning, right? This year I decided that I'm going to follow through with the daily readings on the choice gleanings calendar. So you start with Genesis chapter 1 and Matthew chapter 1 and Job chapter 1. And reading again what God had to say to Adam and Eve. That for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. This was God's plan. This is God's ideal, that marriage be between a man and a woman, that it be a lifelong commitment, and that it be just with one man and one woman. And so you have this fact, the carelessness as to the laws of God. But not only that, we find that as you read the story, and we didn't take the time to go through and read, and we'll look at it more perhaps tonight if the Lord gives help, they were very credulous with regard to the presence of God. And they started to think that the ark was God's presence, not recognizing that the thing that God had stressed right from the very giving of the law, that they were to have no graven image. And you find that one of the Ten Commandments lays this down, that it was not to be in the physical. And yet when they got into a war situation and they decided that they were being defeated by their enemies, what was their response? Send for the ark, bring it out onto the battlefield, and God will be with us. And so superstition took the place of the presence of God. But not only that, it says that they abhorred the offering of the Lord, and there was reason for it. And yet, can I suggest that this indicated a callousness with regard to the things of God? You know, it's very easy for us sometimes, and you hear it again and again, that people say, well, I'm not going to go there because this person is doing this and that person is doing that, or they have all kinds of reasons why people are not going to attend the meetings. But really, why do we come here? It's been pointed out that if you go to the movies, the movie manager doesn't stand at the door and greet you as you come in and show you to your seat and ask how your family is. Or you think of I don't watch much sport. I don't have a terrible lot of knowledge of or interest in some of the sport that goes on. But you look at those stadiums packed with people and people cheering themselves hoarse. It reminds me of what one Irish brother said, his definition of soccer. He said it was 22 fools kicking a bag of wind around the field. And, you know, and yet people will go absolutely crazy for something like of that kind. And yet you ask them to come and sit for an hour in a meeting, and it says that they abhorred the sacrifice of the Lord, the offering of the Lord. And we look at our world and we look at ourselves, and we have to challenge ourselves. Do we fit into some of these categories? Here was a demoralized priest. Here were depraved sons. Here was a disinterested nation. And as you look at it, we think, how can God possibly do anything in a situation like that? And so you find that God is waiting. And we find back in chapter 1 that God's response was to the cry for help from a woman. And this is the amazing thing. W.W. Faraday has written a little tiny book, an absolute treasure. If you ever get a hold of it, it's great. It's called Samuel, God's Emergency Man. Because God was waiting for this woman. And as you look at the story of Hannah's plight, here she was in a home where she was constantly being bombarded with the fact that she was barren. And the two women, and I'm very thankful that polygamy is not something that is very widely practiced in our country. You know, I wonder sometimes how Elkanah put up with it here with these two women squabbling all the time in the house. And this is one of the reasons why God has ordained things the way they are. And you see this woman, she's deprived of that which was the desire of her heart. She wanted a child. I was reading statistics recently, and they estimate that there are something like 5 million childless couples in the United States. And it's one of the tragedies of families, and we don't understand, and we can't really, we don't understand why it is. And then you put opposite that the fact of the scandal of abortion, where women are using abortion to get rid of children. And here is this woman, and she's crying out to God. And not only was she deprived of that which was the desire of her heart, but she was despised by the other woman, by Peninnah. We read that verse 6 of chapter 1, her rival also provoked her severely. And you can just imagine what was going on in that house. Our husband loves me more than he loves you. And that needling, that constant thing that was going on. And the poor girl, she goes up year by year to the house, and it says in verse 7, therefore she wept and did not eat, and the tragedy of that that was in their lives. But notice that while this was true, we find that Hannah, instead of responding to the provocation of her partner, she took it to the Lord. And we find that she went up year by year and prayed about it, poured out her heart to God. Excuse me, I'm going to have to take a... Because you notice that it says, as we saw, her rival provoked her severely. And you can only think that it was insulting words that were being spoken. But I look at that, and that was bad enough. But notice in verse 8. And I read this verse, and I just have to shake my head, because it wasn't just an insulting partner in the house, but it was an insensitive husband. Am I not better to you than 10 sons? And instead of being sensitive to his wife's needs, he's trying to make her feel better. And sometimes husbands, you know, we always seem to manage to say the wrong thing. They say that you ought to put your brain in gear before you open your mouth. But, you know, here she is in this agony of soul. And her husband, instead of being sympathetic with her, he says, "Why do you weep? Why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" That wasn't the answer. Certainly, he was trying to be sympathetic, but really you find that it was insensitivity on his part. But it says that she prayed, verse 10, she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish. And here was the cry of her heart, this intense cry that God would give her a son. Now apparently, as you read the passage, it would seem that this was something that went on over a period of time. And it's been pointed out, the parallel that there is between this couple and Zacharias and Elizabeth in the New Testament. Because it seems that for years this had been going on. And as the children were being born to Peninnah, and year after year, before this girl's eyes, her lack was being made more and more plain. And I have no doubt that it was year by year. In fact, we're told this in verse 7. Year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, she wept and did not eat. But we find that God seemed to be waiting for her to make the step that he wanted. And I want to suggest that it was only when Hannah made the promise that if God would give her a son, that she would give him back. And you see, we see something of the sovereignty of God moving on this scene in this way. And again, you have the same thing as I suggested with Zacharias and Elizabeth. God was waiting for the right time. We read in Galatians that in the fullness of the time, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, that he might redeem those who were under the law. And God's program is such that he's never in a hurry. We need to wait for God, and God is going to work in his own time. And so she makes a promise. She says, "If you will give me a male child, I will give him back to you." But not only does she say that she make this kind of a promise, her desire for a male child, but notice her devotion to God. She says, "I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." And it's suggested that he was a Nazarite from birth, one of the few that we read of in the scriptures. And if you look back in Numbers and read the law concerning the Nazarite, there were three things primarily associated with the vow of the Nazarite. The first was that they were not to partake of the fruit of the vine. And I want to suggest that that is natural pleasures. Now I know that we tend to look at the fruit of the vine, and we read Proverbs and places like that about not looking on the wine when it's red. But we perhaps lose perspective on this, that what God was emphasizing was the fact of natural pleasure. This was something that ordinarily she would, these people would have enjoyed naturally. I was listening to somebody recently, and they were talking about the reason that many people in France drink wine instead of water is because the water there is so bad. Meanwhile, we're importing French water to this country, to French bottled water to drink it. Go figure. But here was no fruit of the vine, natural pleasure. And then there was to be no razor to come upon his head. And I want to suggest that this has to do with natural pride. We like to look good. And we have a young fellow in our assembly, and it amuses all of us, because he comes in and he stands for 5 minutes by the mirror in the foyer, combing his hair and just making sure that every hair is in place. We like to look good. And I want to suggest that this thought of no razor, these men, as they grew and as they lived their lives in this way, they would have looked like wild men. And so there was to be no natural pride. And then the third thing, which perhaps was the most difficult, was that there was to be no defilement with a dead body. I was recently asked to take a funeral. And funerals are difficult things. And to stand and watch the family in front of the casket, and to see the members of the family kissing and touching the dead body that lay there, and you can feel for them. You feel the awful sense of loss that the family are feeling. But one of the things that was given in connection with the Nazirite was that even a relative, they were not to rend their clothes, they were not to come near, they were not to touch a dead body, so that there was to be no natural affection. And these were things, they were to be wholly devoted to the Lord. And this was what Hannah promised, that if God would give her a son, her devotion through him was to be total. And then we read at the end of the chapter that when God heard her cry and gave her son, she discharged her vow. When she had weaned the boy, she took the child in. And I don't know what the age of weaning was or what it was considered to be. Somewhere between 3 and 5. And you can imagine that mother's heart as she took that little child and took him up and handed him over to this old man in the temple. Our time is almost gone. The story in chapter 3 is so familiar. When God called Samuel. And it's interesting, and one of the reasons that I read those intervening verses is that we find in chapter 2 and chapter 3 that three times over we read of Samuel that he ministered to the Lord. Notice in chapter 2, verse 11, the child ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. Alexander McLaren, as he writes about this, he says, he learned his work from the old man, and in obeying him, he served God. So here was this little boy ministering to the Lord, but before Eli the priest. And then you read in verse 18, Samuel ministered before the Lord, even as a child, wearing a linen ephod. And then chapter 3, verse 1. So that three times over, you have it recorded of him that he ministered to the Lord. His devotion, even from this very early age, was to the Lord. But then we read too concerning his mistake. Because even though he was brought up in the house of God. And incidentally, I look at this, and I'd like to encourage parents. And it always encourages me when I see parents bringing their children to the meeting from the time they're very tiny. There's no better place to bring up your children than in the house of God. And this was Hannah's concern, that this child be brought up in the house of God. But notice it says of him, in verse 7 of chapter 3, Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor was the word of the Lord yet revealed to him. And when he heard the call of God, he mistook it for the voice of Eli. And here was Eli lying there with his eyes dim. The lamp is going out. He's sleeping in the house of God instead of serving in the house of God. And the call comes. And Samuel didn't recognize it. And so he ran to him. At this point, he didn't know the voice of God. But you know, one of the things I think that we find in this is God's patience. And God calls in different ways and in different times. And God is persistent in his call. And so he calls Samuel. And Samuel goes running off to Eli. You called me. No, I didn't call you. Go and lie down. And the second time. And then the third time. And God kept calling. And it's interesting that we find in the book of Job that Elihu, when he was talking to Job and trying to offer him comfort, he, not very much comfort, but he said to him, God calls in different ways and at different times, and man does not perceive it. And sometimes it's through dreams, sometimes through pain, sometimes through messengers, that God calls men and women and boys and girls. And maybe God is calling, and sometimes we don't recognize his voice when he's calling to us. But God is patient and God is persistent, and God continued to call until Samuel responded. And so we find that he met the Lord. Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy, and he said, "Speak." He said, "When he calls, you must say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" There's a hymn in this hymn book, one of the old hymns I learned when I was at Sakeji just as a little boy. Hushed was the evening hymn. The temple courts were dark. The lamp was burning dim before the sacred ark, when suddenly a voice divine rang through the stillness of the shrine. And then it goes on, "Oh, give me Samuel's ear, the open ear, O Lord, alive and quick to hear each whisper of thy word, like him to answer thy call, to obey thee first of all. Oh, give me Samuel's heart, a lowly heart that waits where in thy house thou art, or watches at thy gates by day and night, a heart that still moves at the breathing of thy will." And so Samuel heard the voice of God, and responding, came into contact with God. And God gave him a message. And even though he was just a young boy, he gave him a message that was really a message of judgment. But notice that this was the second time that Eli had been given this message. And God will not always send boys to do men's work. And we have to notice that although it was a difficult message that God gave to Samuel, as far as Eli and his sons were concerned, that message had already been brought. And so you find back in chapter 2 that the man of God had come. Here was an unnamed man who had come and brought the message to Eli that God was going to judge. And so he says, if one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? And so they find that God speaks a message of judgment. And notice that as Samuel was going to give this message, it was very detailed. He says, not only will your sons die, but the ark of God is going to be taken as well. And so Samuel was given this responsibility to carry out the message of the Lord. And sometimes we might feel inadequate. Sometimes we might feel that we're not up to the task, that it's not our place to speak to some. And yet we find that because Eli failed, the message was passed on to Samuel, and even as a young boy was required to give that very difficult message. And we find that he did do it. Eli had to press him, but finally he gave the message that God had given to him. And so the Lord help us. The conditions may be in our own hearts, and then to realize that it's going to require a total devotion to God, just as Hannah did with her child, and then to have that meeting with him in the house of God so that we hear the voice of God and are able to pass that word on to others. Lord, bless his word to our hearts. Let's look to the Lord in prayer. Father, we thank thee for thy goodness and care. We thank thee for thy patience with us. We thank thee, Father, that thou art prepared again and again to call. and to wait for our response. And our Father, we pray that we might indeed respond even as Samuel did. Speak, Lord, for thy servant hears. We realize, Father, that there are challenges here for us. It's so easy for us to get caught up in the attitudes and actions of the world that we live in. We just pray that you'll help us, that we might be able to so live as to glorify thee. We ask this in the worthy and precious name of the Lord Jesus. Amen.